This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
There's a number we call the Zydeco Cha-Cha, baby.
That's Clifton Chenier, the late king of Zydeco, in one of his many recordings on Arhuli Records. My guest, Chris Drakwitz, is the founder of Arhuli. It's an independent record label based in California devoted to regional American music like Cajun, Tex-Mex, blues, and country. Drakwitz has traveled around America recording musicians in their homes as well as in clubs and in the studio. Drakwitz also makes documentaries about regional music with filmmaker Les Blank. Their most recent film about Cajun and Zydeco music of Louisiana is called J'ai été au bal, I Went to the Dance. It will be shown on PBS in the fall. This year, Arhuli is celebrating its 30th anniversary. We invited Chris Drakwitz in for a mini retrospective of his work. Though Drakwitz has devoted all of his adult life to recording the indigenous music of the U.S., he was actually born in Germany and came to California in 1947. He told me he first heard the music of the American South on the radio.
I think that was my first exposure to all of it. And I was absolutely wiped out by it. I guess I had a lot of insecure feelings. I couldn't speak the language. I was real skinny. And somehow the blues that I heard, I think, spoke to me the strongest. I'll never forget that first record by Lightning Hopkins. I heard, Hello Central, please give me 209. I want to talk to my baby. She's way on down the line. And it just blew me away. And I also loved hillbilly music. I heard T-Texas Tyler, the Maddox Brothers and Rose. And gospel music. I heard the St. Paul Baptist Church Choir over a station out of Los Angeles. All of that, you know, it was just, the radio was my ear to the world, so to speak. And I think part of my love affair with this music has been my love affair with meeting these other cultures.
When you started collecting records, where did you go to get them? I mean, I think a lot of people thought of 78s as junk that they just sell in flea markets or give them away.
Well, that was at that time the only kind of record. That was the only one in existence. It was a marvelous medium. And it turned out almost every kind of vernacular music was recorded. And I found out it slowly. I didn't have any money, but I would save my allowances. And once in a while, I could splurge and buy myself a 78. And I would wear them out, I can tell you that.
What made you decide to try to record people and meet the people whose records you were listening to and record new records by them?
Well, since I was so enamored with this whole idea of records and what's on them, you know, I always collected things and stamps before that, but records, you could hear what's in those grooves. And I guess I was simply amazed by it all. And when I came up here to Northern California, I met people like Bob Geddens, a black man originally from Texas who was recording here in the Bay Area. And then I met a man named Jackson. He lived on 7th Street in West Oakland. He was recording literally in his back room with one microphone and a disc cutter, you know, where you cut directly to discs. Those early 78s were all done that way. And I simply was amazed that this is all it takes. I first thought to make a record, you go into one side of a factory of a huge place, an artist goes in, and out on the other side come the records. But I had no idea what the in-between process was. And sort of meeting all these people taught me.
Some of the early music that you recorded was Zydeco music in Louisiana, at house parties, in bars. I want to play one of those early sessions. But before I play it, tell us what Zydeco is and how it's distinguished from, say, Cajun music.
Yeah, I didn't know what Zydeco music was either when I first went down there in 1960 or 59, so I simply asked people, what does Zydeco mean? And some of them said, well, it means snap beans, not salty. It's an old tune that everybody knew. Others said, oh, it's just going out in the country and having a party, going to the Zydeco, going to party and having a good time playing music, push and pull, you know, that accordion music. And so that's basically what it is. It's the music of the French-speaking Creoles, blacks, in southwest Louisiana, in contrast to the white Cajun music.
Now, I want to play something that you made in the early 1960s. This is called Tap Dance. It's by a group, McZeal and Gergner. Tell us where you recorded this, who they are.
Well, I'm really not too sure who they were. At that time, I was just wandering around and just asking people. You know, I was driving And they said, oh, yeah, I met them somehow through someone else. And they said, we're playing a little house party. Come on over and join us, you know. And so I did. I simply went to this little house in Lafayette, I believe it was. And they played for me, and there was a bunch of people having a good time at the house. And they were very typical of the little Zydeco groups that were all over the place, usually just accordion and rubboard. In Houston...
Rubboard is like washboard?
Yeah, like a washboard. And at that time, they were still pretty much looked like a washboard. I later found out that some of them would take pieces out of an old icebox where there was corrugated steel in them, and they would cut out a piece that they can scrape on. Because the regular old washboard, see, that metal is much too soft. It just wears through in no time when you're scraping away on it with beer can openers and all that sort of stuff. So they were using a corrugated metal, steel metal, right off the bat. And now it's become a real fashionable instrument that was sort of invented by Clifton Chenier, or by his brother Cleveland Chenier, who was really one of the giants of the whole genre. And they went down to a guy once, Clifton told me, he said, I went down to the steel company and told him, can you make me one like this? And he said he drew it in the sand as to how he wanted it, with this collar on it that would fold back over his shoulders, you know, and then hanging in front of his chest. And they said, sure, we can make that. And that's how these rub boards were made that you see now being worn by almost all the rub board players.
Well, let's go to this 1961 recording that you made at a house party in Lafayette, Louisiana. Recorded in 1961 by my guest Chris Drakwitz, who's the founder and head of Arhuli Records, which is a record company that features regional music from around America and also music from other parts of the world. Had there been much Cajun and Zydeco music recordings made before you started making them in the early 60s?
Oh, yes, lots of them. Not much in the way of black recordings, no, but a lot of the first Cajun recording was made in 1928 by Joe Falcon. But in subsequent years, relatively little black material was recorded, except Alan Lomax did some extraordinary field work in the early 30s. But it wasn't a commercial entity, and really until about that time. And Clifton Chenier had already had a hit by the time I met him, but the one hit had sort of worn out when I met him, and he was absolutely almost insisting that I record him, and he wanted to get a record out back on the jukeboxes, because that was their meal ticket, you know. So he was really the main one that I recorded, because I wasn't sure if I could sell that type of thing. I met Clifton through Lightning Hopkins. They are cousins, you see. And I wasn't sure if I could sell it. I knew I could sell blues, because my European clientele had already told me, you know, oh, we love these blues, and I was beginning to get an inkling of that, because I was selling old 78s to Europe. That's how I actually made my first money, to buy a tape recorder and stuff. But the other things, the French music, I wasn't too sure at all about.
Let's play something by Fred McDowell. Now, this is also one of the early recordings that you made. He was a Mississippi blues guitarist and singer. And probably the most famous record that you recorded of his is You Gotta Move, which was later covered by the Rolling Stones.
Well, I guess that's the one that became famous because they did it, you know. And he was an extraordinary person. I was wiped away when I heard the Alan Lomax collection from Mississippi. And I remember I wrote to Alan Lomax, where is this man from? And he gave me an address in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I went to the post office, where's Route So-and-So? He said, oh, it's out there, north of Highway 61. Go out there. And I met him just getting off a tractor, and I recorded that record there the same night. Not this particular one, but that first album. I don't think he sang You Got to Move on that first night we recorded, but what a wonderful person, Fred McDowell. He loved his music, and he was just as passionate about it as anybody I've ever encountered. And he would play on if you meet him. He didn't care if he's getting paid or not. He loved what he was doing. It was just a sheer joy, that man.
Let me play something that you recorded by him in 1965. This is You Gotta Move.
You got to move, you got to move, you got to move, child, you got to move. But one day long, get ready, you got to move.
Fred McDowell singing You've Gotta Move. Now, this is a song attributed to Fred McDowell. Is it ever hard to tell who actually wrote a song, a blues song? Because there seems to be so many permutations of more or less the same song. And I found in books that I read that sometimes songs are attributed to different people, depending on who you're reading.
It's a real problem. In that particular instance, it's a traditional song, but the arrangement is by Fred McDowell. Reverend Gary Davis also had a very distinctive arrangement of it. But you sort of remind me of the fact that, you know, as I got into this whole music thing, one slowly begins to realize what responsibilities one has. And that was one of the early ones I think I encountered. This whole business of copywriting, because when you're recording someone, or you're really capturing some of their talent, or you're capturing some of their ideas. People who write books, you know, okay, they go to a publisher and they have their books written and copywrote and all that. But these vernacular musicians don't, and so you're really responsible for protecting them. And I learned this really primarily from a good old buddy down in South Louisiana, Eddie Schuler. He once heard my tapes, you know, I played them to him, and he says, Chris, what do you want that stuff for? Get their songs. I said, what do you mean get their songs? I got them right there on the tape. No, man, that ain't what I'm talking about. Copyrights, get their copyrights. If Frank Sinatra or the Beatles want to make a big hit out of it, you know, then if you got the copyright, that's where you make the money, and you share that with the composer. So I kind of learned that, you know. You don't read that in books, but you begin to realize what responsibilities you have in life.
So how did you handle it on You Gotta Move?
You opened a can of worms. Okay. Mr. Klein, who was the manager of the Rolling Stones, he insisted, of course, that everything the Stones recorded was theirs. However, Mick Jagger was good enough to put on the first recording of that particular version that they did the name of Fred McDowell. They listed that as the composer on the Atlantic label. Okay, all hell broke loose. I said, Fred, where did you learn this song? He said, Chris, I learned it out of a book. And then Manny Greenhill, who represented Reverend Gary Davis, called me and he said, Chris, you know Reverend Gary Davis wrote that song, not Fred McDowell. I says, Manny, you and everybody else knows it's a traditional song. It's their various arrangements that may be worth copywriting here, you know. And so we finally headed out and we agreed that as long as somebody would record Fred McDowell's version, which had that slide guitar, very eerie sort of thing, it would be mostly going to Fred McDowell. If they were recording the very finger-picked guitar style of Reverend Gary Davis's version, he would get most of the copyrights, but it is a traditional song, and I think all you can do is handle the arrangement of it. And Fred McDowell was, before he died, he was absolutely amazed. I handed him a check for over $7,000. He says, Chris, I can't believe it, but I'm glad somebody out there likes my music.
Before we hear some more regional music, I want to ask you if you think there is still regional music.
Oh, yes, very, very, very much so.
You don't worry that it's kind of dying out and that things are becoming more homogenized
nationally?
No, people
always talk about that. You know, things change, but they don't die out. But I'm constantly amazed in spite of this extraordinary power that the media has over almost world culture now, you know, these things go on. They evolve, they multiply, it changes, but it's still very much regional things go on. Oh, yes.
Well, let's get to the border region and play some music of the Southwest. You have a film that you did along with Les Blank. It's called Chulas Fronteras,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And, we did that, that's almost over 10 years, 15 years ago, but it's still a classic.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of music are you playing on here?
This is what most people down there call conjunto music. But, of course, the Spanish word conjunto simply means group. In Cuba, they call groups conjuntos, etc. But down there in South Texas, it means a group that consists of button accordion, a bajo sexto, which is a big, fat 12-string guitar, a bass, and drums, usually. And that was the popular music at the time in the 60s. It still is pretty strong, but, you know, tastes do change and the kids go for something a little bit more modern, sort of schmaltzy nowadays. But conjunto music at its best was this absolutely powerful, powerful, what shall I say, vernacular music of that time and the place. You know, it still goes on strong, yeah.
Well, this is the accordionist Flaco Jimenez, and the song is Mojado Sin Licencia.
Mojado Sin Licencia, a wetback without a license. That was written by his father, the late Santiago Jimenez, yeah.
Okay, let's give it a listen. Flaco Jimenez is recorded in the mid-1970s. Chris Drakowitz, what are some of the recent developments happening in border music now?
Well, it still goes on pretty much in that tradition, but they are also, a lot of the youngsters seem to like more the grupos, as they call them. You know, they use electric organs or synthesizers instead of the accordion, and, you know, things do change and so on. But they still play basically a lot of polkas, a lot of waltzes, because people love to dance, and it's still social dancing. It's not just hopping around like Flaco Jimenez once told me. He just came back from his first Anglo gig in Austin, and I said, how did it go? I said, man, those people dance, but they dance funny. They're like kangaroos. They hop around. So I think the music down there is strong. It goes on, and there are festivals now. There's a Conjunto Festival every year in San Antonio, done sponsored by the Guadalupe Cultural Center. It's a marvelous event. Every May, you should go.
You started collecting records back in the days of 78s. You started making records with very, you know, pretty primitive tape recording equipment. Well, now we're in the CD era, the compact disc era, and you are reissuing some of your records on CD and issuing new records on compact disc. I'm wondering what kind of pressures it puts on a small company like yours to enter the CD age. I assume that it's a much more expensive format.
You're
to
right.
Put
just
out.
Just about put me in my grave. I figured I'm either going to retire or get with it. And so I decided I'm going to get with it. So I've spent the last year literally working 12 hours a day, trying to remaster stuff, trying to get money together to do this. I've just spent, I think, close to $150,000, which I had somehow saved up over the last 10 years, because I had a feeling something was going to happen. And so I'm in the CD era now, but it's a very expensive proposition and a time-consuming thing, because I don't want to just put out CDs that simply duplicate the LPs I did. I figure here is a new medium. I should start from scratch. I should go back to the original tapes, and I can make over 60-minute programs, you know, that just really represent the best of the stuff that I taped, and that's what I'm doing.
Do you find that record stores don't carry many albums anymore and that CDs are pushing out records?
Oh, yes, that's definitely. I mean, it's a total insane luxury to have three sound carriers. You know, that's just, it's ludicrous because it's not only time-consuming. I mean, when you have billion-dollar items, then I can see it. You know, they don't really care what form they issued on toothpaste boxes or on razor blades or whatever. But a little guy who only has so much time and money, it's murderous. I mean, I'm spending so much money and time just trying to, and every item like the cassette, the CD, I got to listen to it when it comes back, you know, to test it, make sure it's okay. The packaging, the little inserts, the booklets, you got to read it over again. I mean, it just takes time. And so I don't think the people out there should blame anybody except the guys who invent this stuff. So let's hope the CD hangs around for a while, but I know the chip is coming down the road. Who knows? Oh, boy, will the Matchbox hold my clothes, huh?
Chris Drackwitz is celebrating the 30th anniversary of our Hooli Records this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.